Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Germany is totally controlled by Russia.
Donald Trump's due in the UK today for the first time as US president. Meantime, the US embassy in Britain is currently worried about the safety of Americans during the visit. In fact, it's issued an alert warning people to be cautious as large anti-Trump protests are expected to be held in London.
July has been an extraordinary month in Britain and America. You've had the fervour of England's progress in the World Cup, the President of America siding with Vladimir Putin over the FBI. Brexit has taken yet another left turn with the resignations of Johnson and Davis. And whilst Donald Trump had tea with the Queen, 100,000 Brits protested his very presence and flew a blimp over Parliament to mock him. As a special relationship gets less special, the Mid-Atlantic podcast sees the other side. I've been producing this podcast since 2013, with Mid-Atlantics trying to analyse the news from one side of the Atlantic from the perspective of the other, and it's never been more needed than now. My regular co-hosts include Salon senior political reporter Amanda Marcotte, journalist and writer Mick Wright from GQ, The New Statesman and The Daily Telegraph, Oxford academic and best-selling author Chris Kochuna, and emergency communications expert Doug Levy, and Alice Thwaite, the founder and editor-in-chief of The Echo Chamber. In recent episodes, we have covered the threat or the promise of a second referendum on Brexit, the crumbling special relationship between the US and the UK, and how sporting success and failure play into national identity. And we've even looked at the gulf between Russia's politicians and her people. If you want to share my passion for Britain and my wonder of American politics and culture, why don't you go and download the Mid-Atlantic podcast today? Please forgive a humble podcaster, everybody. I've been podcasting since, 2012? So what's that? Some 6+ years ago. And I've produced some 400-odd podcasts. Now, you'd think, with my wealth of experience, that I would not forget the most essential tool that every podcaster needs. Other than his laptop, of course, it is his microphone. And in this recording with David, I forgot my mic. So my audio sounds just a little bit muffled because it comes off the microphone just on the laptop. Now, what I have done is I've invested in a travel microphone, which can always sit in my man bag with me, so I will never make this mistake again. I hope it doesn't impinge too much on your enjoyment of this show. I think this is a good one. Please bear with me and my dodgy audio as we go through this thorny but vital topic on a very English icon.
It was the best of time. It was the worst.
She was the people's princess.
Little fight on the beaches.
Oh, wait, man. These are the things that made England.
Little fight on the landing ground.
These are the things that made England.
I have the body, but of a weak and feeble woman.
These are the things that made England.
And a king of England, too.
These are the things that made England.
Cry God for Harry!
And these are the things that made England.
England! And St. George!
These are the things that made England.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Things That Made England. The idea of this show is to decide on what things make England the way that she is, the country that, despite it all, we feel lucky to be part of. Every week, one of us, that's David and I, pitch an idea to the other to be designated as one of the things that makes England distinctive. David, what a torturous week we've had trying to record, eh?
It hasn't been easy, Rod Heard. I blame you.
Why?
Well, actually, because I don't want to blame myself.
Well, actually, it has primarily been my fault.
Well, that is because you do all the work. But, you know, it's just easier to blame someone else than me.
Talking about blame, sir.
Right. Oh, yes.
The thing, if you're in the shape of a person that I'm nominating this week, is someone who is blamed for fundamentally changing the fabric of our nation.
Oh, yes. Is that Dennis Amos, the famous Warwickshire opening batsman?
No, he didn't have such an effect on the whole country.
Didn't he change my life?
He didn't. Well, he might have changed yours, but not many other lives around him. But Margaret Hilda Thatcher. Maggie Thatcher, the milk snatcher. Now, she served as a prime
minister.
Never
heard of
it. You have, David. And I know you have strong feelings about her.
Not feelings for her, could I just say? Ooh, that's made me feel quite ill.
Well,
go on.
I'm going to say up front that politically, I don't hold much of a candle to this woman. Though, as a dyed-in-the-wool lefty, I have to admit she did fundamentally change England and the United Kingdom. But she served as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom from 1979 to 1990. When she was toppled by the Tory party. So they got rid of her in the end because she'd overstayed her welcome. She was the longest serving British Prime Minister of the 20th century and, of course, the first woman to hold that office. And the first woman to hold office, such high office in the Western world, if you discount Golda Meir in Israel. She was the most divisive political figure of the 20th century, passionately loved and hated in equal measure. Her legacy is still somewhat debated. Dubbed the Iron Lady by the Russians, and she became an ism in her own lifetime. And she became an ism before Reaganomics, which was, dare I say, a grubby copy of Thatcherism.
We're coming to the moment of decision. As the tumult and the shouting of the last few weeks die away, and you sit at home wondering what to do on Thursday, I can well imagine you saying to yourselves, if only the politicians would be quiet, if only we could sit peacefully for a few minutes and think about our country and its future and the decision you are asking us to make. I know how you feel. The decision is crucial. The problems facing Britain are very grave. I can't remember when our people have approached an election quite as thoughtfully as this one.
It's been a wonderful campaign for you. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
How do you feel at this moment?
Very excited, very aware of the responsibilities. Her Majesty, the Queen, has asked me to form a new administration, and I have accepted. It is, of course, the greatest honour that can come to any citizen in a democracy. I know full well the responsibilities that await me as I enter the door of number 10, and I'll strive unceasingly to try to fulfil the trust and confidence that the British people have placed in me and the things in which I believe. And I would just like to remember some words of St. Francis of Assisi, which I think are really just particularly apt at the moment. Where there is discord, may we bring harmony. Where there is error, may we bring truth. Where there is doubt, may we bring faith. And where there is despair, may we bring hope.
To those waiting with bated breath for that favourite media catchphrase, the U-turn, I have only one thing to say. You turn if you want to. The ladies, not for turning.
I congratulate the honourable gentleman.
There is no doubt that the Prime Minister has in many ways achieved substantial success for the economy. There is one statistic that I understand is not, however, challengeable, and that is that over her 11 years, the gap between the richest 10% and the poorest 10% in this country has widened substantially.
That's right.
How can she say at the end of her chapter of British politics that she can justify many people in a constituency such as mine being relatively much poorer off, much less well-housed, and much less well-provided than it was in 1979. Surely she accepts that is not a record that she or any Prime Minister can be proud of.
Mr. Speaker, all levels of income are better off than they were in 1979. But what the honourable member is saying is that he would rather the poor were poorer, provided the rich were less rich. That way you will never create the wealth for better social services as we have. And what a policy! Yes, he would rather have the poor poorer, provided the rich were less rich. That is a liberal policy. Yes, it came out. He didn't intend it to, but he did.
I give way to the honourable gentleman.
I'm extremely grateful. The Prime Minister is aware that I detest every single one of her domestic policies and have never had that.
And I think that the honourable gentleman knows that I have the same contempt for his socialist policies as the people of East Europe who have experienced it have it for that.
I'm most grateful to the Prime Minister. Will she tell us whether she intends to continue her own personal fight against a single currency and an independent central bank when she leaves office?
No, she's going to be the governor.
On the present structure...
The Prime Minister.
What a good idea. I hadn't thought of it. But if I were, there'd be no European Central Bank accountable to no one, least of all to National Parliament. Because the point of that kind of European Central Bank is no democracy, taking powers away from every single Parliament and being able to have a single currency and a monetary policy and an interest rate which takes all political power away from us. As my right honourable friend said in his first speech after the proposal of a single currency is about the politics of Europe, it is about a federal Europe by the back door. So I'll consider the honourable gentleman's proposal. Now, where were we? I'm enjoying this.
What is Thatcherism, Roy Field?
What do you think Thatcherism was, David?
What do I think it is? I'm not sure that there was a Thatcherism. I think she had a... There are probably some core beliefs that she had. It's quite a complicated question. I would have said she believed in the individual rather than society. Mm-hmm. I believe she picked up a form of monetarist economics, which, although... How far she actually implemented it is questionable. Mm-hmm. But in the end, I think it's in the individual, personal responsibility, duty, those sort of themes which drove most of what she did.
Yeah, but there is a little bit more to it than that. But I think, you're kind of going down in the right direction. Now, I think, for me, Thatcherism is a political and economic credo that emphasizes free markets, because it cannot be said loudly enough that what she did was to rip up the post-war consensus. So we helped defeat the Nazis in 1945, and left and right broadly agree on everything. Okay, so the Labour Party sets up the National Health Service and comprehensive education, etc. But you have Tory governments as late as the early 70s that actually are nationalising industries under Ted Heath. She stops all of that. And so what Thatcherism is a credo emphasising free markets with low government spending and deregulation, particularly the financial sector. Flexible labour markets, so Norman Tebbit, get on your bike and go and find a job. Privatisation of state-owned industries, and that was just about everything. So British Airways through to the GPO. So we had BT spinning off first. But then, after talking about big government, she actually centralised power. So there are lots of quangos. That's where we get the word quango for the first time. And she takes away power from local authorities. Because if you remember at that time in the early 80s, all the metropolitan counties were, in inverted commas, loony left. So you had the GLC in London, you had Greater Manchester, you had the West Midlands Authority over here in Brum, etc. And they're all run by the Labour Party. She gets rid of those. She has a war on unions. And of course, it's tax cuts for everybody, but biased for corporations and the rich, and then with a little bit of nationalism thrown in. You know, she was a flag waver. So I think you put all those things together and you've got Thatcherism.
Sounds very good. Sounds much much more comprehensive than mine.
Now, what did she do? She remade British politics. As I said before, destroying the post-war political consensus. She pushed the Tory party rightwards. And it's almost like a misnomer to call her a conservative, because she was anything but conservative. She was ripping everything up and kind of starting again. And what she does is reject traditional Toryism, which is kind of this one nation, soft right kind of view of noblesse oblige and squires and all of that kind of malarkey. And
paternalistic, yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. And she kind of models the Conservative Party as the party of the small thrusting businessmen. It's the you've done well and you've gone to grammar school type of thing, but you come from humble beginnings. And she kept on saying that she was a grocer's daughter. That was her thing. It was all about simple economics derived from the fact that she came from a grocer's daughter. And this is the reason why I think she needs to go into the cabinet as an English icon, as much as I kind of loathe her legacy, is because what she does do with this remodeling of the Tory party is to help stoke English nationalism. And the Tory party really becomes to be seen as an English party, because even though she wins three general elections, 79, 83, 87, The Tory party continuously losing seats in Scotland and Wales, though she has thumping majorities in definitely 83 and in 87. And this is off the back of her strength in England. And it kind of at that point that, yes, the Scottish Nationalist Party was founded well before she became Prime Minister, but it's very much a minority party in Scotland, that they get wind in their sails by saying we are anti-Tory. And you start to see the fraying of the union really during her premiership, because Scots just go, we are not like the English. We don't want all this deregulation. We don't want these attacks on kind of government spending. This is very much an English thing, it's seen as, and dare I say, a South East England thing, because the North of England is very anti-Thatcher as well. Are you with me so far?
I am, yeah. I mean, the only thing I comment on that is whether Margaret Thatcher set out to stoke English nationalism is a bit questionable. That I totally agree that's what ended up happening, because, as you say, the Scots in particular and the Welsh also hated Thatcherism and all it stood for. But I'm not sure I remember her, you know, being particularly, you know, she was very British, actually. I think she felt very strongly about the union, but small point.
No, I'll completely, utterly agree. And when she waded into the troubles in Northern Ireland, it very much was as a British Prime Minister trying to uphold the Union. She never saw herself as an English nationalist, but the effect of her politics was so divisive that, in effect, how the Scots, and to the Welsh to a much lesser degree, saw her. Wales is a much more kind of complicated issue in all of this, but I think if you speak to any Scottish nationalist worth their salt, they always point to the 1980s under Thatcher as where the Tory party gets cleaved away from Scotland, really. And they see the...
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree about the outcome, as I say. Mm. It's just that I'm not sure that was necessarily her intention.
No, absolutely wasn't. And she was forever waving the Union Jack. You know, there's famous pictures of her, you know, on top of that tank, wasn't there, with a little Union Jack behind her and stuff, and with those goggles on, looking like she was some female Montgomery about to go into battle. And yes, she was. She saw herself as a British icon. The Scots saw her as an English icon. And now we have a devolution in Scotland, and we have the Scottish National Party being by far the largest party in Scotland. And what, some 3-4 years ago, Scotland almost left the Union. You know, you can trace this all the way back to Thatcher.
May well do again.
Absolutely. So.
Yes, she, okay, accepted.
All right, so she was elected as...
Do you want me to say something useful?
Yeah, please do.
Okay, because so your proposal is to put Thatcher into the cabinet as something which has made England. So my attitude towards Margaret Thatcher, Roy Hood, have you ever read a book, the best thing about which is actually the title, by, I think it's Malcolm Bradbury, called Eating People Is Wrong?
No.
Okay, because this sort of sums up my attitude to Margaret Thatcher. Eating People Is Wrong is a very funny book about the liberal dilemma. The inability of liberals, you know, the desire of liberals to hunt with the hounds and run with the hare, the inability to actually agree what is right and what is wrong, down to the point where the only things liberals can really agree on is that eating people is wrong. And actually, even that you might question. So I'm a bit like that with Maggie Thatcher. So personally, I found her utterly repulsive. I could not hear her voice without wanting to, you know, open a vein. I say repulsive, that's a little strong. But, you know, I came out in spots, hives, whatever. Mm. What is a hive? Anyway. And, you know, I hated all the poll tax riots. I hated that polarization of society. I hated that fear of the lack of compassion in the politics. And yet, you know, as a kid watching the news in the 70s, it was just dire. It was just dire. Even as somebody fairly young, the constant industrial disputes, the inability to do anything, you know, the continuing feeling of decline, and it was just horrid, actually, absolutely horrid. And I think we forget that at our peril. So there's this problem with Maggie Thatcher. Here is a person, if I looked back in history and didn't have any personal connection with her, I would say this is a person who, for good or ill, had incredibly impressive characteristics, incredibly determined. You know, her success in staying there for all those years, the amount of change she made, utterly exceptional. But there's quite a lot about what she did that I didn't like. But there's also quite a lot that I thought was quite necessary. So I have a problem with Margaret Thatcher. In terms of whether she should go in to the cabinet as somebody made England, I mean, I'm not even going to pretend to argue. I might say that very often, I think, obviously, we identify individuals with change, whereas, and usually in history, you find a lot more continuity than there is change. And actually, when you look at economic policy, I think that's often the case. Actually, people say that they talked about monetarism. Actually, what she did wasn't anywhere near as monetarist as you might think. That you made the point about decentralization. She was all about get rid of government, and nobody did more to increase the amount of government than Margaret Thatcher, for exactly the reasons she said. She wanted to get rid of left-wing councils. You know, I think when we look back, we take the heat out of it. Probably Margaret Thatcher will go down as somebody who wasn't quite as effectual as we think now, who didn't do everything that she said she'd do. But nonetheless, she changed the atmosphere of England forever, I think.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And I wanted to try and pull you to task about the late 1970s and the unremitting kind of bad news. And I can't. The only thing I would say about all of those politicians that were in power in Britain then was that the oil crisis in, what, 73 and the onset of the three-day week, that has a massive rupture in not just British politics, but actually in world politics. And that's where the American post-war boom, in effect, ends. Though, it's really interesting looking at the economic figures, as I did doing the research for this show, that the British economy, even though we have massive inflation in 76, 77, 78, 79, and inflation gets up to 18% in 1 year, the economy is still growing up until 1979. So even though we have the winter of discontent in 78, 79, we have apparently, in parentheses, unions out of control, we have inflation out of control, and we have to go to the IMF in, what, 76, because Britain has run out of cash, our economy is still actually growing.
Is that real terms, or...?
In all terms. I've looked at this left, right, and up and down. It's only in the last quarter of 79, when she's been Prime Minister for 6 months, then we go into recession, and it's something like a recession for 8 quarters. So it's deep when it happens.
Yeah,
and obviously,
because she deflated it in the middle of her economy, which is, I guess, a little theory, isn't it?
Absolutely. But what she does do, and you said this, is she absolutely changes the mood music. Though, and this is almost kind of lost to history now, she was, for the first 3 years, incredibly unpopular because she wasn't saying things that British prime ministers normally said. She was this divisive figure. She was going to war with bits of establishment think, but it was the war, wasn't it, the Falklands War, which actually saved her and actually really made her reputation. The fact that the Argentinians in April 1982 decided to go and invade the Malvinas, or as they would call it, the Falklands, as we'd call it, these possessions in the southern Atlantic. There's only 2,000 people that lived there, and Argentina had long coveted these kind of barren rocks. And they thought,
I mean, that saved her.
Yeah, her approval ratings are incredibly low, but she decides, well, we're going to recover these. There's no two ways about it. Most Brits have never even heard of the Falkland Islands. It's a roll of the dice by the hunter, General Galtieri. That's it. His name's General Galtieri. They're having some problems in Argentina. They think, we'll just go and grab these. We'll have sky-high approval in Argentina. The Brits won't do anything, but actually we do. And we recover them 2 months later. And it's the last echo of empire. We still are a global player. We grab them back, and she never looked back from there on. And she has this crushing victory in 1983. And then that's really where she then turns up the wick with the deregulation, the privatisation. She goes to war with Scargill, the leader of the National Union of Mine Workers. She starts selling off the council houses. That's when you get full Thatcherism, really, after 83. She just fiddles around with it beforehand. And we have, this is peak Thatch in the mid-80s.
Well, I think, I mean, I'd argue that in a way, the most painful thing, and maybe the thing that she, one of the most questionable things about her economic policy was deflating in that 81 period, because as you say, actually there was growth up until that point. Mm-hmm. And I think the jury is still very much out about whether that was the right thing to do and actually had the effect that she intended, or whether it just deepened the recession. And it's part of that whole lack of compassion thing that I feel so two-faced about with Margaret Thatcher. Because on the one hand, you know, consensus politics had led us into, you know, lack of effective decision making and inability to make difficult decisions. And she was good at that in spades. On the other hand, did that polarisation actually achieve something that made us better? I'm not sure that it did. It made us very different. For example, when Billy Bragg, St. Billy, I keep mentioning Billy Bragg, she's a bit desperate of him, isn't it? But when she died, it was very Billy Bragg. Somebody turned to Billy and thought, well, you know, what's he going to say about this as a long-term activist and a person who fought Thatcher all the time? And whereas there were actually pretty revolting celebrations all around the country at her death, he wrote this very measured thing which said, you know, the death of a person is not something ever to be celebrated. What you should do is go out and be activist, fight the Britain that the ideas that Margaret Thatcher espoused rather than celebrating a death. And for him, Thatcherism was about, well, he said in his quote, why working families now have to have two people have to go to work. You can't do on one. Why there's no social housing around. Why, a whole load of other stuff, some more arguable than others. But that atmosphere of individual over community, that's an interesting question. You know, has Britain really changed? Is it more driven by greed and cynicism, as Billy would claim? Or is it actually the same as it's always been? People don't change and there's, plenty of community around. I don't know.
I think there's a mood music, isn't there? There's a mood music in any community, in any country. So what, let's say what the French tell themselves, that they're a deeply secular society. But actually, more people go to church in France than go to church in the United Kingdom. But, it's kind of national kind of myth building or... And what she did was definitely...
What for avoiding the word mythos, by the way.
Yeah, well, thank you, David.
You did say credo earlier, but, you know.
Did I?
Okay, it's progress. It's progress. anyway, you were talking of mythos, Roy.
Myth. Because my knuckles have been wrapped numerous times. and what she did do, and I know we're kind of slightly repeating ourselves, but she did say that at one point, a famous interview, and she said there's no such thing as society, and it was just a collection of individuals. And there was a strand of Tory thought, radical Tory thought, which was on both sides of the Atlantic, admittedly, starting from the 1950s, which was completely and utterly to do away with all notions of society. And when she comes to power, this is still very much a fringe ideology. But she is the first Western leader to make this manifest. And then Reagan follows it. And the other aspect of Thatcher, just before I forget, and I come back on to really what's her legacy, is that she forges a close relationship with America. And I'm not saying per se that Reaganomics followed Thatcherism. They're both from the same economic political thought. And without Thatcher, Reagan would have done Reaganomics anyway. But Thatcherism does come first. But what she does do is forge a close relationship between the British Prime Minister and the American President, which feels like a personal relationship. And that's kind of really the first time that had really happened. If you think about it, we have, post that, we have Blair with Bush. We have, and we even have Trump and May. Now, I don't think they're actually politically close, but the optics, the hand-holding, and we keep talking about the special relationship, and the special relationship's been around since the Second World War, but there's the photographic optics.
Do you think we all stop talking about the special relationship?
No.
I mean, it's irrelevant, is the thing.
No.
I mean, it's nice, but I would have preferred it if Margaret Thatcher had been less adversarial in Europe, although, of course, it turns out she was a good deal more Europhile than David Cameron, because she didn't screw it up in the way that Cameron did. You know, is it a good thing that she was... Actually, I agree, she did create this... she did get on a personal level with folks like Reagan. I suppose that's no bad thing.
It's no bad thing, but it sets a template for the photo ops of British prime ministers and American presidents ever since, really. But let's just quickly go through her legacy. Deregulation of industries, especially finance, which has led to kind of the loads of money culture and the boom of the City of London. So London is the preeminent money market in the world. It does slightly eclipse New York. That is because of Thatcher. And the fact that now I forget what the percentage is, but I think some 30% of our economy is, but just under 30% is financial services. That is Thatcher, full stop. Privatization of state industries. And we set in place the model for the rest of the industrialized world. You know, we get rid of the state owning car companies, rail companies. We do it first. And we get rather paltry returns in terms of money back into state coffers. And at best, we get patchy service back. And it's going to be interesting, again, doing the research for this, is things like British Steel, which were actually making money as a state-owned enterprise, were lean and efficient, and were absolutely no drain on the state. But ideologically, we still got rid of them.
Yeah.
You know.
I don't know the arguments either way, so I'm not going to challenge your statement.
She battles trade unions because she wants this flexible market. So a legacy, weak trade unions, lots of trade union laws. And I've seen the most obvious day-to-day legacy of Thatcher is the amount of homeless people which we see on our streets. Before Thatcher, there was always a reason why that person was homeless, and invariably it was that some kind of mental health breakdown. And there was, in effect, no homeless within the UK. Now, because of the selling off of council homes, which is a massive demographic shift, she created working class Tories who became kind of Daily Mail readers, who were thrusting and aspirational in a way which hadn't been seen before in British / English society. And it's interesting, when you think of those loads of money people, they're always English. We don't think of Scottish loads of monies. We don't think of Scottish people buying their own homes and then changing their front doors and then putting in double glazing windows. It always was the sign that someone has bought their own council home. And though people will say, well, you know, why couldn't people buy their own home? But what the Tory government clearly said in the way of social gerrymandering was that councils couldn't build the equivalent homes again.
So, well, in terms of outcome, it's an interesting one because, you know, it's very easy to make a lot of very firm, definitive statements. And of course, there are so many variables in these things.
David, this is the thing which I'm actually firmest about, but go on.
But so I absolutely agree with you about social housing, for example, that that's one of the great reasons why we've got this flood of homelessness, and it's got particularly bad recently. But clearly Thatcher didn't invent the working class Tory, otherwise she wouldn't have got elected. Nonetheless,
she does give them rocket fuel, though, doesn't she? So places like Basildon in Essex become bastions of this new type of English person, somebody who will wave the flag of St. George, white van man. White van man kind of comes into his own in the 1980s. The Sun newspaper has been around since the early 1970s, but it's the totem for this new type of Englishman, isn't it? Then, you know, that loves Thatcher, sees himself as ordinary, likes a bit of flag waving, is jingoistic, and has bought their own council home.
Well, these are the headlines. I mean, this is what the media would have us believe.
And the podcaster.
I would need to understand what happened before better to understand whether that reflects a change in the visible and the superficial and the way that people represent themselves, or whether there was actually any fundamental change in
let's say she gives them voice, because, you know, you are right that history is something of incremental change, and you know, things don't radically change overnight. It wasn't as if all of a sudden she gets elected in 1979 as working class Tories. And there were, you know, in popular culture, there were people like Alf Garnett beforehand. So, you know, this phenomena was there before. But it very much was the zeitgeist of the 1980s that you have this kind of bellicose, upwardly mobile, element of working class people, ostensibly in new towns in the southeast of England. So and that has never left English culture.
But it's quite interesting, isn't it? So what happened after Thatcher went?
David.
Everybody went back. But my point is is the question of the fundamental nature of change. I think we attribute far more to Thatcher than we should do. Actually, I think we don't remember enough about detail. So the miners' strike, for example, the incredible conflict there, the fact that Arthur Scargill was absolutely right. On the other hand, so was Margaret Thatcher, probably. That there's that pain in detail. The way she handled that was incredibly adversarial. Maybe there was no other way of doing it. Maybe it didn't have to be done. I don't know. But there's a detail there which Thatcher was not good at handling that situation, if it could have been handled. Or at least the way she handled it led to a lot of pain.
Let's just look at the miners.
Sorry, just to finish. On the other hand, so there's a detail thing. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, these big themes about, Thatcher made us more individualistic, more greedy, blah, 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 blah. I really doubt those things. What happens immediately after Thatcher has gone is we get back into much more consensus-style politics.
But now this is where I'm on absolutely on quite sure ground here. All right, so what she does do is to not only change the Conservative Party, but she changes British society. So we do have this cleave between England and Scotland. In 1950, was it the 1958 elections? One or the other, but the Tory party is the majority party in Scotland.
I put the Scottish thing to the side because I absolutely agree with you.
Okay, all right. So she changes the Conservative Party by making it more libertarian and more radical. So it's less of a Conservative Party and just a right-leaning party, a right-of-centre
party. She gets rid of that old paternalistic...
Absolutely.
Oh, I'm going to start mentioning Rees-Mogg, aren't I? You know, that sort of hideous old-style stuff.
Absolutely. She calls them the wets, doesn't she? James Pryor, people like that. But she changes British politics. Yes, the SDP is formed because of a leftward lurch of the Labour Party, but it's also because of a rightward lurch of the Tory Party that David Steele and David Owen want to create a more robust centre. And she changes British politics so much so that we don't, when we get Tony Blair in 1997, we don't reprivatise all of our state industries. We don't say we need more regulation on industries. We have a little bit more to do with finance, and then we take the Bank of England out of control by the government. But actually, we don't wind things all the way back, do we? Any stretch of the imagination. And the heir of Thatcher actually isn't John Major. It's actually Tony Blair. That here is somebody who comes out with a David Crowther interpretation and says, we maybe needed to do a lot of the things that she did, but we didn't need to do it in the way that she did it. So I am warmer, I'm cuddlier, I will talk to you about your insecurities, etc. But actually, the socio-economic way that the state has been run for the last 20 years, I'm going to keep this going. And that shows you how much of a legacy that this woman actually had, because the party directly opposite was fighting tooth and nail all the way through the 1980s. Lock, stock and barrel by 1997 really just is a continuation of her policies. But with, and you know, we don't put all the metropolitan councils back together. We don't deprivatise local transport. So in my hometown of Birmingham, you cannot get a night bus after 12 o'clock. It's absolutely ridiculous. You know, we continue with her policies, and that is her true legacy, that she completely reshapes British politics. And I can't say it loudly enough, she made the Scots hate us.
So yes, I agree that she absolutely changed politics. That we didn't go back and reinvent those things. I absolutely agree with that. I think, however, what happened once that dial had been moved, mm-hmm. politics returned to the centre. That centre was differently positioned. I agree.
Yes, exactly.
But the whole atmosphere then changes. You know, everybody was desperate to get back to the to a rather more reasonable debate.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, you did say this as well, that actually she was a Europhile. You know, on the face of it, people like Nigel Farage will say that she's a Europhobe. But no, she wanted reform from the European Union from within. She didn't actually want to come out. But many Brexiteers would see her definitely as the heir to her... their quest for moving us away actually from Europe. But
her rhetoric was very aggressive, basically. Yeah. That's what the way Thatcher was. Her rhetoric wasn't collaborative. Actually, I think behind the scenes there was rather more sensitivity and collaboration going on. There's a little bit of Henry VIII in Thatcher.
I thought you were exhausted with Henry VIII.
No, not yet.
It's been a year, you said, and I'm exhausted.
We've got a vote going on the History of England right now, you see. And
you
when
never
that,
stop that, plugging over. Your own podcast, do you?
It's true. Well, because, you know, what else is there? There's air, water, you know, heat, power, light, and my podcast. Anyways, a little bit of Henry VIII in Thatcher, a lot of rhetoric, actually, in fact, rather more sensitivity and ability to change and be adaptable than you might at first think. Anyway, I mean, it's a
small
point.
What's your evidence? Because it's hard.
I think that was why she fell, actually, because she stopped reading the runes.
Hmm.
You know, she stopped being able to compromise, to work people into alliances with her. She was all, you know, the power went to her head. She came utterly hubristic and it was her way or no way. So the poll tax thing, you know, going through with that was, you know, the kiss of death for her, really, wasn't it?
Mm. Absolutely. But I would say then that she wasn't somebody to compromise. But you said that behind the scenes that she did much more. And for evidence that she wasn't somebody to compromise was the fact that the cabinet becomes a less important thing under her premiership, that she's much more kind of dictatorial. And cabinet power up until, let's say 83, the cabinet, was a much more powerful body in terms of I'm the Secretary of State for transport or health, and you're kind of left to kind of get on and do what you had to do. But you look at the biographies of all of those Tory ministers in the 1980s, and they say she did wield a massive shadow over everything that everybody did, and that basically the cabinet was a little bit becomes more of a rubber stamp for what the Prime Minister actually
Although that is interesting, isn't it? I mean, you look at this is me, so you know I could be completely wrong about it. But think about the figures that we remember, the politicians that
we remember
after Thatcher, and compare them to the people that we have now, and think about their weight and reputation. The likes of Douglas Hurd, Geoffrey Howe, even Heseltine. Mm-hmm. Actually, these are people with some. Kenneth Clark, when Kenneth Clark spoke in Parliament not too long ago about Brexit, suddenly everybody sat up and listened and thought, this is a guy who knows what he's talking about. So despite that feeling of dominance, I don't deny that Thatcher drove the government and was the centre, you know, nothing went on without her approval, as it were. Actually, the government was well served by some quite talented people, whether you like them or not.
Norman Fowler, John Selwyn Gummer, you know, Norman Tebbit, her utter ideological Rottweiler.
Yeah, what's your point?
My point is that we do remember them 30 years later, that this was a time of of Tory politicians, Tory cabinet members whose legacy and whose names actually do echo down through history in a way that when Tony Blair comes to power, yes, there is Gordon Brown, etc., but and Clare Short, but we do not remember the 10 others.
Could just be us, of course, because I understand you're almost as old as I am.
Yeah, that's very true.
I've not realised that.
David, exactly. We talked about this on numerous times, and each time you're always surprised when I say I'm like 4 years younger than you. Anyway, shall we?
Yes.
I think
enough.
We're both in complete and utter agreement that.
Yeah, hated it or loathe it. We need to put her in there in the cabinet. I might have a little separate section in the cabinet. But that, that reflects my liberal inability to make a decision. It's appalling.
Hmm.
I recognise it in myself.
Very un-Thatcher-like.
Very consensus, post-war consensus politics-like. Right, so in the cabinet she goes.
David, after that mammoth discourse about a woman, which neither of us actually quite liked, so what I think we should do is absolutely kick our feet up and see what Fiona has come up with a social media roundup.
Fiona here with the social media roundup for the Longbow edition. David proposed the Longbow as cabinet worthy. Roy Field refuted David's claim and stood by with a hefty set of keys and an argument against its merit. Then it was up to you to decide. So I'll take a shot and look at the poll. 73 people were for putting it into the cabinet, 8 people against, 5 people opted to sit this one out. All right, I told a little fib. First I'll look at the poll, and now I'll take my shot. Archers, knock your arrows. Draw. Fire at will. Archers? I said fire at will, not at Royfield. And the discussion. As usual, there are so many wonderful posts on the Facebook page that I can only offer a few of the highlights. Jan was very amusing, first scolding Royfield, then reminding us of the Battle of Towton. Battles of this era usually started with a to and fro between archers, Jan said. Finally, one side or t'other got hacked off with being turned into hedgehogs and sallied forth. There were many, many mentions of Robin Hood, but since my melting point is always children, it's Tiffany's post that caught my attention, as it came with a lovely picture, and she reminded us that pretending to be Robin Hood is still a big deal with the under 10 crowd. Ben said, having now actually listened to the episode fully, I think David's case is decisive, not because it was some kind of super weapon, but because of how it was incorporated into English mythology. Andrew was firmly on Royfield's side, concluding his post with, "Time has consigned the longbow to the past. Let it rest in peace." And on the other hand, Thomas said, "Without the longbow, this podcast would be called Things That Made France Junior." And Anthony, "Without the longbow, no Crécy or Agincourt, no Henry V speech for Shakespeare. Put it in the cabinet all day long, though I'm sure it was the Welsh who did all the fighting." I do like the cut of your jib, Anthony. There are 107 more comments on the longbow alone. And every single post is worth a gander, especially the ones complimentary either to the longbow or to the Welsh. Not that I'm biased or anything. I'd like to draw your attention to the file marked Files on the left-hand side of the page, where under the heading File, David has posted a file which can be added to, by you, of all of the topics that have been suggested for the podcast, from Helen Mirren to the Prime Meridian and every hedgerow in between. It's a healthy list, but this is your page, O listener, whose condition has been gentled. Feel free to make it overwhelming. Luke will be covering the Maggie Thatcher roundup. I know that my esteemed colleague already has wonderful plans, but please do try and overwhelm him. In a fortnight, the topic will be Magna Carta. Till then, stay in sight, but stay out of target range. And I'll leave you with my take on what we should do with Maggie.
Not arrow. Draw. Shoot.
Thank you for that, Fiona. David, she's
yes,
in
Royfield.
The milk snatchery thing. This one I forgot to say. I remember as a little kid, when I started going to school in, 1974, that up until about the age of seven, you had milk at school.
Yes, and I had short trousers. That might be a local thing.
That wasn't obligatory in Birmingham to have a short trouser, but to have milk absolutely was.
I remember milk, and we had straws in them. They're rather nice little bottles.
Yeah, and blue straws. And I was a milk monitor.
Were you? Do you know, I never had any responsibility at school.
Did you know? I was a milk monitor, and in my last year of senior school, I was a prefect as well.
Were you really? So you're
part of the establishment.
So yeah, that is interesting, isn't it? So unlike our, you know, public personas now, you are in actual fact the man. Yeah?
Well, I wasn't the man at school. I was very much a boy.
You were a prefect.
Yes, I was a prefect. Wait, I had the little badge and everything. Oh, yeah.
God, you know, I'm appalled.
I was a stooge of the establishment.
Yes, you were the establishment. And there was I.
But anyway,
I wasn't a rebel. I just didn't have any interest in anything other than football, basically.
And of course, I mentioned milk because, as I said at the very start of the show, before she became Prime Minister, she was known as Maggie Thatcher, the milk snatcher, because under Ted Heath, she was the Minister of Science and Education, and she stopped free milk going out to school kids in the early 1970s.
There you go.
The witch.
There you go.
All right, so
enough about Thatcher.
Yeah, let's say goodbye. In the next episode, the next exciting episode of The Things That Made England, David, what will we be discussing?
I think we will be discussing Magna Carta.
Oh,
Royfield.
God.
I know it. I was thinking, actually.
Oi.
We're establishing a pattern here, aren't we? You do, you know, interesting, modern, cultural, political, modern things, and I do old farty stuff.
Yeah. Quite apt. Old farty stuff.
Yeah. I was born at the age of 45, obviously. Anyway, enough. We need to stop.
And these are the things that made England.
And St. George!
These are the things that made England.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.